Hey folks, Ben Birch here from White Rose Society. I don't usually interrupt your regularly scheduled programming, so I'll keep this brief. I am currently holding a fund drive to keep White Rose on the air. If you think what I do here is valuable, please visit our homepage at www.whiterosesociety.org and chip in to defray the substantial costs of this service. Thank you very much.
Governor of Illinois, Mr. Blagojevich, is, how do you say it, in deep doo-doo? Yeah. Big problem. Hello, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Governor Rod Blagojevich and his chief of staff, John Harris, taken into custody this morning. You know, at first blush, yesterday, he stands up for a bunch of workers at the Republic Windows and Door Company and suspends state business with the Bank of America. And you would think, oh, my God, that's the kind of thing that, you know, for a politician, that's a huge risk. Might that cause him to get into some trouble? And then, of course, today, well, toward the end of the day, yesterday, he's arrested. But my personal take on this is that it probably is, you can flip this upside down. If there is a political calculation in this, it's probably more Blagojevich's than it was Patrick Fitzgerald's that the governor saw this coming. I mean, generally, if a federal indictment, a federal arrest, particularly at this level, is not something that takes you completely unawares, although who knows, that he saw this thing coming and figured, okay, what's the best way to go down like a martyr? I don't know. Is that what's going on? In any case, it's as they say in the news business, it's something that's going to sell a lot of newspapers. We will continue to talk about it a bit throughout the day here. The 76-page FBI affidavit, the indictment that he was basically trying to sell Barack Obama's Senate seat. It's not going to reflect well on Obama, so of course the corporate media and the right-wing media in particular are going to just love this thing. They're going to be all over it. But as I said, it's the sort of thing that's going to sell a lot of newspapers, which brings up another story of this week that I think has been dramatically underreported and is arguably, I think, probably one of the most important things that's going on right now, and that is that we've got a whole bunch of newspapers that are absolutely melting down. The Tribune Company has filed for bankruptcy protection. Sam Zell is the guy who put this thing together. They own the Chicago Tribune, speaking of Chicago, the LA Times, the Baltimore Sun, more than 20 television stations. Mark Zussman is on the line with us. Mark is particularly insightful about the newspaper business in as much as he co-owns and runs, edits the statewide Oregon weekly newspaper. It's called Willamette Week. WWeek.com is the website. But it's one of there's papers like this all over the country that seem to be doing quite well. Mark Zussman, welcome to the show.
Tom, good morning. Glad to be here.
And great to have you with us. Mark, what is the state of the newspaper business, and how much of this is attributable to the business itself, to the whole Craigslist phenomena, you know, classified ads and things like that, versus this article on the front page of today's Financial Times that basically suggests the whole reason that this thing is going down is because Sam Zell bought the Tribune Company for $8.2 billion. He put up only $315 million of his own money. So this guy puts up $315 million, and he buys a company for $8.2 billion. All the rest of it is debt. In fact, there's now $13 billion worth of debt total attached to this company. That this was a leveraged buyout in the finest tradition of Ronald Reagan the Reagan years. And it blew up when the credit market started going down. What are your thoughts?
Well, Tom, a couple of thoughts. On the one hand, what happened with the bankruptcy filing of the Tribune is a bit of an anomaly. I do not think you're going to see many other newspaper companies filing for bankruptcy, but I'll get back to that in a second. What you said about Sam Zell using an enormous amount of leverage, which is a term we're hearing a lot today in the collapse of financial markets, is absolutely true. The interesting thing is that a good deal of the money that Zell received to purchase the Tribune came from employees' pension plans.
That's right. And in fact, this
so a number of people who work or who have since retired their pension, their retirement is now in absolute jeopardy, and my guess is that it is going to be down the drain.
Yeah, this is the Financial Times today. In a Delaware court filing, Tribune reported assets of $7 billion and debts of $13 billion, suggesting that the employee share ownership plan, which backed the buyout, will see its equity wiped out.
And apparently, reporters who took a buyout and took severance payment or deferred compensation have already been alerted that those payments have been discontinued and, quote, will be the subject of later proceedings before the bankruptcy court,
right.
Which means, you know, they obviously can't count on it. But despite the anomaly of the Tribune and the extraordinary degree to which Zell leveraged the purchase of his newspaper, and the fact that it is an anomaly, it is an illustration of the larger travails that the entire newspaper industry is going through and the serious transformational journey that anybody in this industry is going to be traveling over the next decade. And frankly, you know, while it's taking place during a bad economy, and I don't want to suggest that the bad economy is not in part at fault. I mean, I can tell you here at Willamette Week, we're down over last year. There are some larger issues that you can't blame the economy on that frankly I think you can blame the newspaper business on for years of inertia that have to do with their lack of innovation, their complete ignorance of cultural trends. And as a consequence, there is a degree to which our business made its own bed, and we now have to sleep in it.
To what extent, Mark Zussman, with the Willamette Week, WWeek.com, I've known you for a couple of years. You're an astute observer of this business, and you know, here in Portland, there used to be the Portland Oregon Journal and the Oregon. I mean, there used to be multiple newspapers here 30 years ago. Where I grew
right.
up in Michigan, there was the Lansing State Journal, there was the Detroit Free Press, there was the Detroit News, there were half a dozen other papers that you could get statewide. But there were two big statewide papers, a Republican one and a Democratic one, you know, a management one and a labor one. All over the country, typically a major city would have a dozen newspapers. We have not only gone from those days to basically, well, here in Oregon, we have one statewide newspaper. Michigan basically has one statewide newspaper, the Detroit Free Press / News. You know, it's consolidated, as it were. And that's not unique. I mean, the same thing when I lived in Georgia. You had the Atlantic Journal Constitution or Constitution Journal, which was the merger of two former rival newspapers. To what extent might this also be symptomatic of Reagan suspending enforcement of the Sherman Antitrust Act and Clinton to some extent with the Telecommunications Act going along with that, so that we end up with this Tribune Company sort of situation where, Sam Zell also owned 20 television stations. I mean, you know, in addition to all these major newspapers, that it's, you know, Bernie Sanders talks about how, you know, when a company's too big to fail, it's too big to exist. Have we reached the point where, and is this also symptomatic of right across the board, all these other companies as well, from whether it's the chemical industry or the automotive industry or the computer industry, or fill in the blank, the software industry, the newspaper industry, just one more company to show the stupidity of monopoly?
Tom, you're absolutely right. I mean, the dirty little secret of the daily newspaper business is that it has been operated as an unregulated monopoly for decades. And in a number of those cities where there were two, you know, Portland's a good example, where there were once two daily newspapers and now there is one. Well, what happened was that the bigger one bought the smaller one.
Right.
It wasn't that the smaller one couldn't exist. It was that the bigger one saw that if it could buy the other one and be the only daily in town, it would have, you know.
But the bigger one is now owned by a company in New York.
It's owned by the Advance Company, which is the Newhouse family in New York.
Yeah.
And as a consequence of being an unregulated monopoly, two things happened. One, it made unbelievable profits. And two, as often happens with a monopoly, when it fears no competition, it gets lazy and arrogant. Newspapers traditionally spent no money on research and development, no money to innovate, because they could do exactly what they did last year and their profits would be the same. In fact, they might even be greater. And so actually the story of the decline in newspapering is not the story of the collapse in earnings over the past year. It's the fact that over the past 10 years there has been an extraordinary decline in readership. And it's only now that the money is beginning to trail the lack of readership.
Right, right. We're out of time, Mark. I'm sorry. Actually, stick around and I want to pick up that quick thought of yours and also ask you what the web has to do with this on the other side of the break. Stick around. Mark Zussman's with us. He's with Willamette Week. WWeek.com is the website. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio. TomHartman.com, AirAmerica.com for a free live chat room and video stream. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For full show podcasts with no commercial interruption, get Air America on demand. Sign up now at AirAmerica.com. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmerica.com.
Everybody falls off the track. There ain't one rule, there ain't one map. Come on, keep the light on. Been gone so long, my jeans are faded. I've seen this world, man, it's so overrated. Come on.
21 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman Radio Program, brought to you in part by the Teamsters, proudly supporting the Employee Free Choice Act. More information at Teamster, singular, Teamster.org. And so here's my working hypothesis. We've got these the Tribune Company and these big newspapers and television stations going down in flames. We've got companies all over America going down in flames. We've got the auto industry going down in flames. We've got chemical industry, Dow Chemical today announcing huge layoffs that they're idling over 100 factories right across the board. And I lay all this at the feet of Ronald Reagan and Alan Greenspan and the religion of monopoly is fine. Let's stop enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act. These companies all got so big that they got stupid and they got lazy and they failed to adapt to the times because they thought, hey, we own the world. We own the industry. Nobody else. You've got, 94% of all the media consumed in the United States, non-internet media, 94% of all the non-internet media consumed in the United States is in the direct or indirect hands of seven corporations. And I think big newspaper just got too big and too stupid. And Mark Zussman is still with us with Willamette Week. And then we got Bob Nea is waiting on the line to talk about what's going on in Chicago. Mark, you wanted to make a quick point about your thoughts.
Yeah, well, a couple things. First, in terms of readership, there are now fewer daily readers of newspapers in America than there were in 1946 when the population was half of what it was. And that's in part because of daily newspapers' complete unwillingness to innovate. And I want to make a contrast with our paper and papers like ours who actually have more readers than we did last year. And there are a couple of very simple things that daily newspapers could do to turn that around. But to get to your point, Knight Ridder, one of the storied newspaper chains in America, was sold a few years ago to McClatchy. And it was because its shareholders, some very big institutions, were upset that Knight Ridder was only turning 20% to the bottom line. Well, I can tell you my newspaper company has never brought 20% to the bottom line. So they then sold to McClatchy with enormous amounts of leverage. And McClatchy got in way over its head. The Miami Herald, perhaps the most storied newspaper of the Knight Ridder firm, winner of many Pulitzer Prizes, is now on the market because McClatchy just got in way over its head because of exactly what you were talking about. And we are seeing, as we are in many other industries, the unwinding of an industry that is more than an industry. It's central to our democracy.
Yep.
Because
the fourth
of
estate,
this taking on of debt.
Yeah, the fourth estate. I mean, it is the function of the fourth branch of government, as it were, in the minds of many of the founders. One of the reasons why they subsidized the production of newsprint. And to this day, going back to something that Ben Franklin first suggested, we subsidize the mailing of newspapers with fourth class postage rates. So, anyhow, Mark, I got to move along, but thank you very much for your insights. Great talking with you today. Very much appreciate it. Bob Nea is on the line with us. Bob, with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, a regular contributor to our show. Bob, first of all, welcome.
Hey, how are you doing?
Just great. You are, in addition to being a reporter with the Talk Radio News Service and working with Ellen Ratner, Former Republican congressman from Ohio, you were on the receiving end of a federal corruption investigation. Yesterday I was praising Governor Blagojevich for his grandstanding, essentially, saying that we're not going to do business with the Bank of America and let's put these workers back to work in Chicago. Today I'm wondering if that was just that, exactly nothing more or nothing less than grandstanding, trying to get out ahead of the press knowing that this hammer was going to fall on his head. What are your thoughts about what's going on in Chicago right now?
Well, you know, I don't, of course, know the details of what happened. My boss, Alan Ratner, and I talked, and Alan is furious over the fact of, you know, why were the feds doing the wiretap if it was rising to this nature, affecting Illinois? Why was it not done by the state? And she's pretty adamant on that thought about, you know, why the wiretapping wasn't done by the state.
I think Patrick Fitzgerald had been running this investigation, much of this investigation, and mm-hmm. he's, of course, the federal prosecutor. And the sale of a federal office, the United States Senate, is more than a state issue.
Right, but I had to add what my boss feels.
Sure. Okay, you got it.
Needed to do that. But as far as what's going on with the governor now, you know, I've been down that path sort of, to some extent, but as far as you know, what he did, maybe he knew it was coming down, you know, maybe he didn't. I know in my case, we really didn't know our chief of staff was wired up and basically taping the entire office. Mm. And including personal conversations that had nothing to do with, you know, Jack Abramoff.
Right.
So when this happens, it will be a lot of pressure. And the other thing I'd point out is this, you know, a lot of the conversations of what was taped have been released publicly.
Right.
So that's almost trial, conviction, execution before anything can even happen. I was surprised at the amount that was actually put out there publicly. But he probably had a sense of this because usually with this, there's leaks, people start talking to each other, and pretty soon, you know, it gets back around.
Yeah, you think Fitzgerald might have released this in advance so that he wouldn't be accused of trying to take out the governor who was standing up for the little guy and going against Bank of America?
I mean, they probably, you know, when you've also got the, interesting enough, the Chicago Tribune is in this thing. As a result of that, you know, who knows who knew what when, in the sense that, you know, people started talking and maybe the governor knew about that.
Right. And the Chicago Tribune, now also owned by the Tribune Company, which is in bankruptcy, which we were talking about the last few minutes. So.
Right.
Ah, what tangled webs we weave. Bob Nay,
yep.
Bob, thanks a lot for your insights.
Thank you.
Great to hear from you today. And we'll talk with you or somebody from Talk Radio News a little later on in the day with our daily news update. 27 minutes past the hour, 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Your thoughts on these and the issues of the day.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
This is Ted Sorensen, proud to be talking on Air America.
This is your home for progressive talk. AirAmerica.com.
Welcome back.
Have you seen the bigger piggies in the starched white shirt?
Piggies alert for the day.
Bigger piggies staring at the dirt. Always have clean
shirts. They always have clean shirts, yes. Well, the latest thing for the piggies, it's $475,000. It has temperature-controlled sheepskin beds, a spa, an expensive hi-fi system, a 52-inch plasma TV screen, a retina scan at the entrance makes sure that it is the right dog who is entering this new doghouse that, yes, you too can buy if you just can write a check for $475,000. Can you spell wretched excess? Probably Sam Zell can. Hannah in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Hannah. Welcome to the show.
I'm one of the LA Times retirees. I now work for the biggest jail in the world. And it just makes me want to cry to see people who are sitting in a jail cell because they bounced a check for $200, and this guy stole my pension fund. Shouldn't he be sitting in a jail cell?
I think you can make a very strong case for that, Anna.
Yeah, and it's like, and in addition to the pension fund, in the 1930s there was a employee assistance fund that when the company was taken over, it had, I think, $80 million in it.
Mm-hmm.
And that just vanished.
Yeah.
It was an employee, like, if you couldn't pay your gas bill, they would give you the money. And that
right.
money just evaporated.
Yeah.
So it's our pensions. You know, I can't tell you. This is just heartbreaking.
Yeah.
This man stole my money.
Yeah.
Theft makes thieves, and thieves should be sitting in jail. And that's all I have to say, Tom.
Yeah,
bye.
You said it very well, Hannah. Thank you very much. This is what we are seeing here is the natural evolution of Reaganomics, of Thatcher-nomics, of Milton and Thomas Friedman-nomics, of greed is good, and only the strong survive, and all those cliches that are absolutely destructive, both to a rational economy, to any industry, and to democracy, small d democracy. Steve in Atlanta. Hey, Steve, welcome to the show.
Hey, Tom, I was hoping you could help me win this water cooler war. I was having my carpool buddy. I'm down here in Atlanta, right? And we only have one newspaper, and really a bunch of conservative stations and not many liberal stations. And I was pointing out how all these people down here just get one side of everything.
Yep.
And he was saying, well, why aren't there more liberal radio stations or newspapers? And why is that? It seems like businesses usually fill in voids. Why don't more liberal stations come down here to Atlanta?
Actually, Steve, you know, early on, Air America had had an affiliate in Atlanta.
Right.
And a group of Christian businessmen got together and bought it. They ran the campaign, their fundraising campaign to buy that station to other wealthy Christian businessmen in Atlanta was, we need to get these liberals off the air. And
right.
they bought the station and flipped it to Christian programming, and it's not making a whole lot of money. The fact of the matter is that in Portland, I beat Rush Limbaugh in the ratings. In Seattle, I beat Rush Limbaugh in the ratings. In Los Angeles, this show beat Bill O'Reilly 2-1
right.
in the ratings. You know, on those stations, we're doing well on radio stations all across the country. The Chicago affiliate's growing like a weed. They just added the 3 or 4 FMs to the AM signal so that they're
right.
reaching a much larger area. On those places around the country, where you have people, whether they be conservative or liberal, because I'll tell you, most of the stations on which we're doing really well are actually owned by Clear Channel, which
uh-huh.
is theoretically a relatively conservative corporation, although I would say, you know, having worked with Clear Channel for years and years, that they're really just about making money. But it was Mitt Romney's company, Bain Financial, that bought them out. But the point is that it's not about ideology. It's about good business sense. And there's this huge herd mentality in this industry. And people don't. They don't make changes and they don't jump until you can prove that something's successful. And frankly, if you look back at Limbaugh, it took Limbaugh a couple of years to be successful. If you look at Fox News, here's the ultimate statistic to use to win your water cooler war. Everybody says, oh, you know, look at Sean Hannity, how successful he is. He just got a $200 million check for his show. You know, Sean Hannity's one of the wealthiest guys in America now.
Mm-hmm.
The first 5 years that Fox News ran, they lost $100 million a year for five straight years.
Mm-hmm.
Roger Ailes and Rupert Murdoch lost $500 million before they made $1 off Sean Hannity. And so you can call that socialism. You can call that investment. I would call that an investment, a long-term investment. And
but you're kind of asking my same question. Is if it is profitable, it's been shown to be profitable in your markets.
Yep.
Why isn't anybody taking advantage of it here in Atlanta where there is no market? I mean, where
well,
the market
right now,
nobody...
it's a good question. I mean, you know, we've been knocking on a lot of doors in Atlanta for our show. And,
yeah.
you know, it's radio is a monopoly business, basically.
It must take more money than I think it does.
Pardon? Yeah. It's,
it must just take a lot more money than I
if
think
you
it
want
does.
To flip a radio station, it costs $2 million, you know. And or if you wanted to buy a radio station, but not that I know anybody's trying to do that. I mean, we're just saying, hey, you know, pick up our programming. We've got good programming. There's a good show, and there are many others out there. Part of the problem is that you've had massive consolidation in the industry. Part of the problem is there's a limited number of signals. Part of the problem, I'd say, but I think in my personal opinion, Steve, the biggest problem is inertia. That people,
mm-hmm.
This is the most risk-averse industry there is. Nobody ever got fired for doing nothing. And so people in this industry, even if they've got an underperforming station, the second, third, fourth tier conservative station in a market like Atlanta, they're saying, well, you know, we're still at least breaking even or making a little bit of money. I'm not going to take a chance. I'm not going to take a risk. But as the word travels, and it is traveling, and we're running ads in the trade magazines about it, about the kind of ratings that this show is getting, because this show is getting absolute kick-ass ratings in most of its markets, and it's true of many of the progressive shows as well, by the way. I think that you're going to see more and more of this. And the other thing that's going to flip more and more of this is the fact that Barack Obama was elected, that a lot of progressives were elected, that progressive is, to use the phrase that they use on the Los Angeles station on K-Talk, the new mainstream. And that this isn't, you know, just some odd, you know, whatever you call it. It's not just radio, by the way. On the internet, you find progressive websites massively outnumber and outperform and are more profitable than conservative websites. Some of the conservative websites recently are laying people off. In television, you're seeing, you know, what are the hottest new shows in television? Rachel Maddow and Keith Olbermann, you know, so I think, frankly, we're going to see a renaissance right across the board in media. And maybe part of that has to do with the dysfunction of the newspapers. Who knows? Randy in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Hey, Randy.
Hey, Tom. I want to comment on your little bit about the newspapers getting too big for their britches and, of course, the readership going down. The readership is going down because people want real news, and they're tired of fluff mixed in with a couple of bits of truth here and there, but mostly fluff.
Yeah.
You can't read hardly in this country, especially a big headline story about CIA planes being found with, you know, drugs and crashing or founding on tarmacs, just loaded with drugs. You can't find the stories of the people, you know, who are out telling those stories. And then, of course, you know, they're the purveyors of the big quote-unquote conspiracy theory when those stories do appear.
Yeah.
Then you get the big talk show hosts like Hannity and the other groups to say, you know, it's a conspiracy.
Yeah,
people want truth.
No, you're absolutely right, Randy. And people want all sorts of local news, and they want real reporting, and they want people uncovering stories, and they, you know, and all of these things have gone away with monopoly, basically. Whether, you know, regardless of the industry, but particularly in the media, all of these things have gone away with monopoly, and it's not been a good thing. 866-303-2270, our number, Bill in Chicago. Hey, Bill, what's up? We lost Bill. Let's go to Henry in Los Angeles. Hey, Henry, what's on your mind today?
I just would like to say that the problem with the commercial radio, commercial newspapers, and all that is the inherent conflict of interest that they have, of wanting to make a profit and by entertaining people rather than by telling them, the people who, you know, subscribe,
right,
let's say, the truth that may not be pleasant.
Right.
May
well,
not be,
you know, any kind of media has to
and
be
that's
entertaining.
One of the reasons why Ben Franklin wished to subsidize some of this media, and radio wasn't around then.
Yeah. Well, and Franklin and his peers, and they did. I mean, Congress passed legislation in the 1790s subsidizing the manufacture of newsprints so that newspapers could stay in business, and so that there would be a diversity of newspapers, and subsidizing the almost virtually free at that time delivery using the United States Postal Service, which Franklin also helped invent, to deliver newspapers to people's doors, in large part because they saw it as the fourth estate. You had the fourth branch of government. You got the legislative, the judicial, the executive, and the news. And that's why the First Amendment of the United States protected the news. And
I have a question.
It's a sacred trust, yeah.
If you, being in a commercial, Clear Channel outlet, were subsidized by the government instead of by the advertisers, do you feel that you would be more free to talk about things that may bite the hand that would otherwise have fed you?
Henry, for cars. I'll take on GM even when they're advertising with me, but NPR doesn't.
Yeah.
NPR doesn't, and when they exposed Archer's Daniel Midland, and that led to a $300 million fine to ADM, biggest in history for price fixing, all of a sudden ADM was sponsoring NPR. I mean, you know, I'm still scratching my head around that one. 45 minutes past the hour.
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman Program. This is your home for progressive talk. AirAmerica.com.
So this is Christmas. For black and for white. For yellow and red ones. Let's all stop.
Nine and a half minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And just a quick reminder to our friends listening on KPOJ in Portland, Oregon, which used to be Portland, Oregon Journal, speaking of old newspapers, that's where the call sign came from, that tomorrow night at 7:30 at Powell's Books in Burnside, I'll be signing the new paperback edition of Cracking the Code and hopefully many other of my titles that are in print. And so be there, be square. It should be a lot of fun. It should be very interesting. Senator Shelby down in Alabama yesterday talking about the possibility of filibustering, Republicans filibustering any kind of financial stimulus package that, or any kind of bailout, rather, for the auto industry. This is the same state, Alabama, that offered $220,000 per job created to Mercedes to put an auto plant in their state. So, you know, and the low end of that calculation was $153,000 per job that the state, combined with federal money in tax grant, tax reductions, grants, and outright gifts, basically, were given to a variety, a wide variety of auto manufacturers to locate themselves in Alabama. The low end of the figure is $153,000 per job. Yeah, that's in the first year. Obviously, they're expecting the factory is going to be around more than 1 year. So after, if the jobs are paying $15,000 a year, after 10 years, they start breaking even. Right? But if you figure $153,000 per job and you want to save a million jobs, that's $153 billion. And the big three, we're talking about arguably 3 million jobs, which would be, what, almost $500 billion, and nobody's asking for that amount of money. But that's the level of subsidy that was given down in Alabama by Senator Shelby, who is now very sanctimoniously trying to tell us, along with several of his Republican colleagues, that, well, you know, we shouldn't bail out the car companies. I'll tell you what the difference is here. Banks are the holders of money of very wealthy people, particularly these very large banking institutions and these large speculative institutions, J.P. Morgan, and et cetera. They're the holders of rich people's money. The car companies in America, they're the holders of working-class people's jobs. So who do you think the Republican Party is going to give a damn about? Well, the holders of rich people's monies are in trouble. Let's give them hundreds of billions of dollars, and we're not even going to ask a question. The holders of a couple of million working-class jobs are in trouble? Well, let's beat them up pretty badly. And that's exactly what happens. That's exactly what happens. Anyhow, back to our topic of the newspapers as well. Debbie in Portland. Hey, Debbie, welcome to AM620.
Hey, Tom.
Welcome to the program.
All I can say is if Sam Zell had a dog, he'd buy that doghouse.
Yeah, that $145,000 doghouse. Yeah. Sam Zell, of course, the guy who put in less than $200 million of his own money to leverage a almost $9 billion buyout of the Tribune Company, threw it $13 billion into debt, wiped out the employees who went into the thing, wiped out the pension funds, and now, as a consequence, the L.A. Times, the Chicago Tribune, and others are going down the tubes.
Well, I think he has a bit of a God complex. 10 years ago, I was working in Sun Valley, Idaho, where he has a home. And he had an annual event called, I don't remember who it was named after, but let's say it was the annual Billy Bob Memorial Ski Classic.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd have, you know, bags and things printed up with that, I guess, so that the members would maybe pass each other on the train in New York. They'd see the bag and realize that they'd both been there. But he would basically plan the future of the world with these other billionaires. And 10 years ago, they didn't really ever want the staff around. But I remember overhearing something where he said, okay, remember, Brazil, look at Brazil.
Yeah.
That was 10 years ago.
That's interesting. Interesting. Denny, thanks.
Yeah, well, Nick, he's tell you a whole lot more details, but
I tell you, he's not alone in having a God complex, but what's going on is that because, and thank you, Debbie, for the call, because we changed the rules of the game in the 1980s, because Reagan changed the rules of the game of Monopoly, Sam Zell was just playing Monopoly, and he got caught. But it's all about Monopoly. John in South Carolina. Hey, John.
Hi, how are you?
Just fine, thank you. And you?
Good. Well, I'm calling, first of all, I love your show. I live in Reno. I listen to you on XM and also the Reno station, and I happen to find you driving through South Carolina. But what this all reminds me of is I grew up in Eastern Europe as a child, and everything, and the only news we would get is we would have to listen to a crackly radio and listen to Radio for Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And no chance of...
John, your phone is breaking up. I'm sorry, John, your phone is just breaking up. I'm hearing a little of it. I'm going to put you on hold here. Maybe we can pick you up a little later on. Ann in Orange County, California. Hey, Ann.
Hey, Tom, I think I can follow up for him. I get really frustrated. I love you to death, and I've learned so much from you, but I get frustrated on this topic, and you just did exactly what frustrates me, because you, and I love your optimism that it would be wonderful that the media companies are just out for a buck, but then you turn around and told the story of the Atlanta station that got taken down by Christians who specifically said we need to get this liberal message off the air.
Yep.
And we have to think back to when this all started back with Reagan.
Yep.
And the media
and Bill Clinton, let's not hold harmless.
Wait, real quick, let me say this. To get what they want, which is consolidation, they need Republicans. And the Republicans need to get their other messages out. So it's an ugly little cabal that are each getting what they want.
Yeah.
And
no, I don't disagree with you, Ann. I don't disagree with you. It's and this is the part of the problem. But from Clinton's signing the Telecommunications Act in 96, Reagan, the Fairness Doctrine, but mostly the anti-monopoly laws, that's where our media has gone down the...
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio, broadcasting live coast to coast and streaming around the planet. Barbara Boxer, Senator Barbara Boxer is on the line with us, the senator from California. Perhaps she's not. Senator Boxer. Senator Boxer?
I'm with you.
Ah, you're with me. Okay, great. You are the chairwoman of the Senate Committee on Environment and Public Works. And you held a press conference yesterday to talk about the stimulation of our economy, the stimulus package. First of all, broadly speaking, your take on where we're at and what we need.
Well, we're at a very bad place. I mean, we didn't really need the official declaration that we were in a recession. I think I could tell you from my state's perspective, California, we certainly knew that. We're now over 8% unemployment, which in and of itself is very, very painful. So we need to do what it takes, as President-elect Obama says. We have to do what it takes. And here's the good news. The good news is, in order for us to be competitive in the 21st century, we need to rebuild our infrastructure. The further good news is that when we do that, we not only create so many jobs, and it's really about 35,000 jobs for every $1 billion we spend, but we need to do this in the long term. So you're not making work, you're doing important work. In the same way, when you step up to the plate on global warming and look for alternatives to fossil fuels and the oil we import, you're also strengthening the economy, and you're creating millions of new jobs, putting solar rooftops on and the like. and creating alternatives that the world wants. So at the end of the day, what we want is to jolt this economy now, as President-elect Obama has said, jolt it now, do what it takes, and then know that what we're doing is not wasting money, but we're doing things we would have to do anyway.
Senator Boxer, how do we make sure that the infrastructure that we're building is not supporting America becoming essentially a third world proxy country for a bunch of corporations from outside the United States, as we're seeing maybe our auto industry moving in that direction? Vesta, for example, is the largest manufacturer of windmills in the world, and soon to be one of the largest manufacturers in the United States. All the profits go back to Denmark. The solar panel industry, the largest manufacturer of solar panels in the world, is a British company, British Petroleum. They're doing most of their manufacturing in China. How do we bring these jobs to the United States, all these innovations? I mean, we created the transistor here. We invented radio and television here. We don't even make these things here anymore. How do we make sure that we don't create a wonderful physical infrastructure, and ideally an intellectual one as well, by putting people through college at a low cost, and not have that basically be supporting companies that are taking all their profits back out of the United States?
Well, you're talking about the need for a manufacturing base, and I've always
Yes.
believed in Buy American. I mean, the fact is we need to make sure that we save our manufacturing base so we could get into the whole situation with the automobiles as an example. But, you know, the fact is when we rebuild our infrastructure, I guarantee you the companies here in America are the ones that prosper.
So are you suggesting that we need a change in our trade policies?
Well, I'm very strong for fair trade. I don't believe that you stop trade, but I think you need to have fair trade, which means you have reciprocity with nations and the like. But let me again stress, it's not true that all the solar panels are made outside this country. I could tell you, in Ohio they're producing them, in California
Yep.
they're producing them. So we don't want to lose that. And if we go ahead and we do this and we start doing what President-elect Obama has suggested, which is making our schools energy efficient and so on, and we put these rooftops on and we do all that it takes to build windmills and all the rest of it to get us off foreign oil, that's going to benefit domestic industry. Doesn't mean that every single
Absolutely.
Raw material is going to be from America, but for the most part, we will prosper here. And you can't outsource the job of putting a solar roof on. It's got to be done right here in this country.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And there's so much that we need to do, and it'll save so much energy when it's all done. We're talking with Senator Barbara Boxer. Boxer.Senate.gov is her website. She is the chairwoman of the Senate Committee on Environment and Public Works. Just one other quick question for you, if you don't mind.
Yeah,
Jeff Sessions and Richard Shelby, your colleagues from the great state of Alabama, the two senators from Alabama, are bloviating, if I may, at some length about possibly filibustering, even offering even a small amount of money, relatively small, given what was given to the banks, to
Right.
to the American auto manufacturers. Alabama offered a $253 million incentive package just to Mercedes, and that's one of seven non-U.S.
Yeah.
based companies that they offered such things to, including $250 million worth of free land. This worked out to $220,000 per job created in Alabama. Now, they expect to capture that after, if these people are making $15,000 a year, after maybe the 13th year, Alabama will start seeing some profit theoretically, but this was an investment. If they're willing to invest, and this would be the equivalent, if we're talking creating 3 million jobs at $200,000 a job, we're talking, the equivalent of $500 billion. That's the scale that Alabama was supporting foreign manufacturers in the United States. I mean, if the tables were turned and Karl Rove was running this thing, he'd be saying, and he was a Democrat, he'd be saying, Jeff Sessions wants to sell American manufacturers down the tube and have nothing but Japanese and German manufacturers controlling everything in America. I mean, that's how do these guys get away with this, and how are you all going to push back against it, assuming that you're interested in doing so?
Well, I'm definitely interested in pointing out the hypocrisy of that. And it's unbelievable to me that you really do have these politicians, including I saw Mark Sanford also
Yes.
stand up there and say the same thing when in his state he did the same thing. The fact is, this is my own take on it. These guys don't seem to care about blue-collar workers. That's all I could say. And, they don't really care about these particular blue-collar workers. They say it's all, you know, they get paid too much, even though they've given back so much. Their pay's around now about $28 an hour. They don't care. And they, you know, it's laissez-faire when it suits them, and then when it doesn't suit them, they go the other way. But my view is this. We don't want to be the only industrialized nation in the world not to have a domestic auto manufacturing industry. It's very bad for us in the long run. And in the short run, it's horrible. Could add as much as 3 million new job losses. I've got 200,000 workers tied to the big three in California. The fact is, we can't afford it. We need this bridge loan. We can do this now. We can restructure. They say let them go bankrupt when they know full well no one's going to buy a car, or very few people, from a bankrupt company because they're worried about parts and service and all the rest. But I'm really glad that you are, in fact, pointing out this hypocrisy. It really means a lot to those of us who are trying to fight for this. I got to run, and I want to thank you so much for this opportunity.
Thank you, Senator, for being with us. I appreciate it. Senator Barbara Boxer.
All right. Bye.
Thank you. Great having you on. And Ellen Brown is with us. Ellen Brown has over the years been a guest on the show many times, and her website, webofdebt.com, and the author of the book of the same title, and just a brilliantly insightful person into the economics of our nation. Hey, Ellen, welcome.
Hi.
Your most recent article, Sustainable Government, Banking for a New Deal. You're suggesting that we go to the most macro, the biggest of the big pictures, and say, let's not just, as Barbara Boxer was suggesting, let's not just look at building roads and bridges. Let's not even just look at bailing out domestic industries and trying to keep them alive. Let's reinvent our currency, our banking system. Do I have that right?
Right. Our banking system is bankrupt. And by law, those banks should be put into bankruptcy. And by law, they could be taken over by the FDIC and nationalized. And we would have a national banking system without changing anything. I mean, that's just proceeding according to the laws that we have right now. But I think what we should do is also nationalize the Federal Reserve, which, of course, is the head of the private banking system. Right now, the Federal Reserve is talking about $8.5 trillion in bailout money. Well, where are they going to get that money?
They're printing it.
Right, but it comes from the $700 billion that was authorized by Congress, and then what they're going to do is leverage that by a factor of 10, which is how banking works. You know, all of our money comes from bank loans, money that is created out of accounting entries. It didn't exist until it was lent. So I assume that's what they're planning to do with this.
Right. I'd like to continue this conversation, Ellen. We have to take a break. Can you stick around?
Yeah.
We're talking with Ellen Hodgson Brown, the attorney and author, webofdebt.com, her website. How do we create a sustainable government? How do we reinvent our banking system to do it? And this, frankly, this may be the most important. This is the debate that Hamilton and Jackson and all, back in the day, but now it's really.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Fresh opinions and news you can use. This is your home for progressive talk. AirAmerica.com.
Here's a little world you can all join in with. It's very simple and I hope it's new. Make your own life up if you want to. Any old life that you think will do.
21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Viagra for your brain. The Tom Hartman radio program. Okay, here we have the, as Ellen Brown writes in this new article at webofdebt.com or also in the Yes Magazine, as noted by Barry Ritholtz in his December 2nd article, the bailout has already cost more than the New Deal, the Marshall Plan, the Louisiana Purchase, the Moonshot, the Savings and Loan Bailout, the Korean War, the Iraq War, the Vietnam War, and NASA's lifetime budget combined. Thomas Jefferson, she notes, realized two centuries ago there's a way to finance government without taxes or debt. However, he came to that realization only after he left the White House and was unable to put it into action. Ellen Brown, webofdebt.com, What is Jefferson's solution to today's disaster?
The solution is that the government itself should be creating our money supply, and that's where most people think money comes from. If you ask anybody on the street who makes our money, they think it's the government. In fact, it all comes from private banks.
Except for coins.
Except for coins, which is just a token. It's just a remnant of what they put in the Constitution, which is that Congress shall have the power to coin money. In fact, I read somebody's opinion. I think it was somebody from the Mint said that you could solve the whole problem by printing or stamping 10 $1 trillion coins. I mean, today that's what it would be. And then you just pay off the debt with these $10 trillion worth of coins, because it doesn't say in the Constitution what the face value of those coins would be.
Oh, that's amazing. Now, let me just wrap my brain around that for a minute. Here's the reason, just to back up a little bit, the reason that the U.S. Mint is making coins and not the Federal Reserve Bank, and the reason why our coins don't say Federal Reserve pennies, they say actual U.S. money, is because our coinage, the Constitution says that the federal government has the exclusive right to manufacture coins.
Congress shall have the power to coin money, and that's all it says about creating money. It doesn't say who has the power to print money or to create, obviously, electronic money or all those forms that we use today.
Right. So what the Fed has done is it's said, okay, government, you guys are in charge of pennies, nickels, dimes, and quarters, and we're in charge of dollar bills on up. And so the Treasury Department could simply say, okay, we're going to start making $100 coins, $1,000 coins, $1 million coins. And by the way, we'll make a $1 trillion coin. And with 10 of these coins, which we will print, we will buy the Fed. Do I have that right?
You don't even need to buy the Fed. It's in the Federal Reserve Act that Congress could just vote to nationalize it. I mean, it's in the act. Well, the last provision of the act is that it can be modified by Congress at any time.
Right.
So they gave it the power. They could take back the power.
Sure. So what would be the practical effect of the Treasury Department saying, okay, the Federal Reserve, which is a private corporation, which is creating and controlling our money supply, is no longer a private corporation. It's now part of the Department of the Treasury. We are going to buy it from its investors. We'll pay whatever the price is, and now we own it. How does that accrue value to you and me?
Well, right now, the Federal Reserve has always bought federal debt, but they haven't been so obvious about it. But right now, right on their books, they're stating that they're buying a certain amount of U.S. debt. So what you have is the government printing these IOUs and then the Federal Reserve printing money and trading it for the IOUs, and then we owe the Federal Reserve the money plus interest. Well, if it was our Federal Reserve, we wouldn't need to print debt. We could just print money, which is what our debt really is.
But that would immediately inflate our currency, wouldn't it, and decrease the value of it?
What you would do is you would print the dollars instead of the debt. In other words, you would rip up the bond. So you would print.
Right.
Every time a bond issue came due, you would print the dollars and pay off the bond issue, as they always do, or they put it into accounts.
Right.
But you would rip up the bonds instead of rolling them over. Now what we do is we roll them over, and then we go, because nobody else wants our debt, you know, less and less do other people want our debt. The Fed is more and more stepping in to buy the debt.
Right. I mean, there's one speculation that one of the reasons the Fed is buying so much federal debt right now is because the Chinese aren't. But still, it seems that this is the Zimbabwe solution. I mean, if a government just prints money, if they say, okay, we're going to build highway infrastructure and we're going to print the money to build it, if they're increasing the number of dollars in circulation, but they're not increasing the net wealth, so they're decreasing the value of the currency. And you would have inflation, would you not? Although we're going to anyway by creating money with debt.
Right.
When the Federal Reserve buys it.
It's more inflationary because the Federal Reserve keeps the bonds.
Because they leverage
those bonds. Yeah, then they use them as the reserves for 10 times that sum in loans.
Right. So the Federal Reserve takes all the dollars that are created by creation of debt of the Fed and multiplies them by 10. And if the Treasury did it, it would be multiplied by one. So it would be one-tenth as inflationary. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I don't think it would be multiplied at all because you would rip up the bond, and the bonds themselves are the basis of our entire money supply. Those are the reserves from which our
right.
money is created.
So let's just nationalize the Fed. Now we've got to get some senators on board on this, Ellen. Ellen Brown, webofdebt.com. You can read all about it. Sustainable government banking for the new deal. We'll be right back. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Traveling attitude, the ones that matter most.
Talk radio for the rest of us. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. And downright strange stuff out there. This is great. I got this email from Robert in Portland. Breaking out the compensation packages for a few folks. Let's see. Rick Wagoner, the CEO of General Motors, he makes $9,500 an hour. Alan Mulally, the CEO of Ford, he makes $10,000 an hour. Randall Stevenson, the CEO of AT&T, he makes $12,000 an hour. Rush Limbaugh, he makes $18,000 an hour. Sean Hannity makes $9,600 an hour. Bill O'Reilly makes $4,800 an hour. Rupert Murdoch makes $14,963 an hour. And everybody is yelling about the fact that starting out auto workers at GM and Ford and Chrysler are making 14 or 15 bucks an hour. I mean, you know, where is the... This is incredible. And then here, this Ron Gettelfinger, the president of the UAW, he says, since 1992, states where we have transplants, these are non-union foreign corporations building cars in the United States, have put in over $3 billion in incentives. And I would point out that is the money that the states settle for, and I want to go specifically to Alabama, if I could, for a minute. This is Gettelfinger speaking. He says, we have Hyundai Motor Company that got $252 million in incentives. Toyota there got $29 million in incentives. Honda got $158 million. Mercedes, $253 million. It seems odd that we can help the financial institutions of this country. We can offer incentives to our competitors, our foreign competitors, to come to this nation and compete against us. But at the same time, we're willing to walk away from an industry that's the backbone of our country. As it turned out, Alabama offered $253 million, but the state offered to train the workers, in addition to this, to train the workers, clear and improve the sites, upgrade the utilities, buy 2,500 vehicles. On top of this, the state gave the automaker a large parcel of land worth $300 million. So, yeah, Alabama, bail out Toyota or help out Toyota, help out Hyundai, help out Mercedes. Sure! Those are not union jobs. I'm telling you, what it comes down to for the Republicans is that the banks are the holders of the money of the rich people in America, and they've got to protect that at all costs. No questions asked. $1 trillion, no problem. The big three automakers, yes, of course, there's a million changes that should be made in how they're doing business and the kind of cars they're making and what they're making, sure. But that's the small stuff. The big issue for this is that the banks hold the money of the wealthy. The auto companies hold the jobs of working class people, about which the Republicans don't give a flying fadoodle. They just don't give a damn. So, anyhow, Peggy in Sonoma. Hey, Peggy, what's up?
Hi. I was wondering, with all the money that's being printed for the bailouts, do you think it's going to result in hyperinflation, us trundling wheelbarrows of money around, like Argentina, or something like that? And if you do, when do you think that will come down the pike?
I don't expect personally that we're going to see hyperinflation like the Weimar Republic or even as bad as Argentina or like Zimbabwe with 10,000% per month. I do expect that as a consequence of spending more money than we spent on World War II in 1 year, that we are seeing two things here in operation. Number one, this is a continuation of the Reagan-Stockman Greenspan Norquist plan of what's called Starve the Beast, make governments so broke that they can't fund social programs, because we can't have social programs, because then you're going to have people speaking out and wanting decent wages and taking a little chunk out of the rear end of the very, very wealthy in this country. So part of it is starve the beast, and part of it is basically predators just, you know, running off with everything they can get successfully. And part of it is that they're protecting their own, you know, the hustlers, basically, you know, these bankers who were betting these credit default swaps and all these other derivatives, all these bets and all this gambling that was going on when Alan Greenspan opened the casino back in the early 90s, and Congress really opened the casino in 99 with Phil Graham's help, so they're covering their butts. That part, that butt covering, that covering of the hundreds of trillions of dollars of derivatives out there that is being done to the tune of, so far, around $7 trillion by the Fed, I think that is going to be inflationary. And I think that my personal opinion is that it's going to be probably worse than what we saw when we saw the fighting of the Vietnam War and the funding of Lyndon Johnson's Great Society at the same time, both with debt in the 60s. And the result of that was the inflation of the 70s, which led us to, you know, prime rates of 12, 13, 14%, home mortgage rates of 18, 19%. Credit card rates at that point, just prior to that, had been limited to a maximum of 10% by law. That law was repealed, the usury laws, but they, you know, got up around 20%. Well, now they're over 30% in some cases, or pushing that. I would expect that a year from now or 2 years from now, you're probably going to see interest rates, functional interest rates, or inflation rather. We're going to see inflation that's probably going to be something on the order of 15 or 20% per year, which would be very, very destructive if it's sustained for more than a year or two. But it's also how the Republicans, I think, for a long time have figured that they'll run up all this debt and then they'll inflate their way out of it. Look at how dramatically inflation has increased since Reagan came into office. You know, how much money it takes now to buy something compared to what it took. I remember when the Ford Mustang came out in the 60s. You know, it was shockingly expensive. As I recall, $2,400 for a brand new car. And, I mean, that wasn't that long ago. And so that's how much our currency has crashed. And I expect that there's going to be more of that. And, in hyperinflation, people on fixed incomes, the poor, those on Social Security, they're the ones who get hit the hardest, and the rich always find a way to shelter their income. But, Peggy, I don't have a crystal ball. It's just my guess. I think that we need to do everything we can to avoid the hyperinflation. Bill in Chicago. Hey, Bill, what's on your mind today? Bill?
Hello?
Hey, what's up?
Yeah. I somehow I got cut off the last time, so I've been waiting around. Well, first of all, I want to say I love you. I love your show there.
Thank you.
And I happened to read Strauss and Howe's Generations before you turned me on to the fourth turn.
Ah, they're both great books, aren't they?
Extremely, extremely well written.
Yeah, they are.
And they're extremely insightful into the future.
Well, and for our listeners who don't know what we're talking about, just a 30-second summary here. Strauss and Howe wrote these two books, The Generations of America and The Fourth Turning. And The Fourth Turning in particular, I found resonant. They suggest that there are these four generations that continuously repeat themselves, and that you start out with a generation that experiences a depression and a war, and that experience causes their children, you know, growing up in that, causes them to be the generation that quietly builds and puts the nation back together, and their children, seeing their parents kind of rebel against that and become the generation that says, no, we want spiritual enlightenment, and we want to, you know, transcend the materialism and the hard work, and they become the, you know, basically the hippies and the protesters, and they challenge the authority, and then their children say, oh, that was all crazy stuff, we just want to get rich. And then the wretched excesses of the generation that just wants to get rich blows up the entire economic system and produces another Great Depression and war. And every 80 years, basically, every four generations, this comes around. And the last 80 years ago is the Republican Great Depression of the 1930s. 80 years before that, it was the Whig Great Depression, the predecessors of the Republicans of the 1850s. 80 years before, or the 1860s, led right to the Civil War. 80 years before that, it was the Depression of the 1760s and 1770s that led to the Revolutionary War. And then they go all the way back in England to the War of the Roses and so on. So anyhow, that's Strauss and Howe's book, The Fourth Turning, a great book. Anyhow, Bill, that's not what you called about.
Yeah, No, no, I just wanted to, I had read Generations and you turned me on, like I said, to the other one, and it was insightful in that it took it one step further.
Yeah.
What I want to talk to you about is like the Republican win, or the Republican, nice name, windows and doors in Bank of America.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you really want to hurt them, you learn from the shortistas. The union members simultaneously sell short their stock and then short sell the stock. And I suggest to you, if you do that, the board will capitulate.
And this is because the union members own
stock?
Well,
I'm just saying, a lot of times, you know, union members have stock options in their companies. Now maybe Republic, you can't do that to. I'm a union member, and they sell stock at a discount to me.
Right.
And I'm just suggesting that, you know, if you really want to hurt somebody like Bank of America, and you do own their stock,
right,
you sell it.
Well, there is, you know, there is an ESOP involved with the Republic, but I don't know to what extent, how much. I would be surprised if the workers owned enough stock to really affect the company.
Well,
and
yeah,
I'd be amazed if any of them owned any stock in Bank of America. You're talking about people who are kind of on the bottom edge of the wage scale, and most of them,
you know,
Hispanic.
But I'm also going, you know, how you said boycott them. Well, this is a boycott plus. You know, if like, yeah, I just sold my Bank of America stock.
Right, right.
You know, I mean, that's, I don't own them anymore because I don't believe in them. I mean,
yeah.
I'm just saying that that's a way to get to the board.
It is.
If everybody sells their stock, the stock will go down, and the board will say, you know what, the boycott might hurt.
Yeah. You know, it's a shame, Bill, is that you're not one of these guys in Wall Street who can naked short, you know, 40 million shares of the stock blow it up. I mean, that's... Bill, I'm sorry we're out of time, but as opposed to that as I am, it would be come up, and it's 46 minutes past the hour.
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman Program. This is your home for progressive talk. AirAmerica.com. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program on AirAmerica.com.
So be careful in what you believe in. It's plenty to get you confused. And in this land called paradise, you must walk in man's shoes. Bigotry and hatred are enemies to us all. Grace, mercy, and forgiveness will help a man walk.
Nine and a half minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Just a reminder, Powell's in Portland, Powell's in Burnside, 7:30 tomorrow night. I'll be signing the paperback edition, the newly released paperback edition of Cracking the Code, and hopefully a few others of my titles as well. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Ready News Service is on the line with us from Washington, D.C. Ellen, hey, what's going on in the world today?
Well,
how are
thank
you?
First of all, I have sent your article that you were quoted on as being right about ADHD to many, many people. So I just want you to know, I'm your press agent.
Well, thank you. Just so our listeners know what we're talking about. Back in 1991, I hypothesized that attention deficit disorder was actually a positive adaptive genetic trait that would help hunting-gathering people and wasn't all that useful for farming people. And we're mostly farming people these days, and industry is a variation of that. And I was ridiculed, many people in the field called me names in public, including in the New York Times and Time Magazine. I was attacked, and I continued to write about it. I wrote 7 books on the topic. And last year, the genetic research came out, and a few months ago, the National Institutes of Health actually held a conference at which a peer-reviewed presentation was made that said, and literally, they came right out and they said, Tom Hartman was right. So, thank you, Ellen.
Right. Okay, so there you have it. I think your analysis is brilliant. So I know you talked to former Congressman Bob Nay about the Illinois governor.
Yes.
I don't know if he told you my view on that, which is why are we wiretapping all of these governors? legal or not, illegal or not, I have a problem with it, I got to tell you.
Well, but apparently, I don't know that it's all these governors. I mean, apparently Blagojevich is, you know, is a corrupt politician, and we're talking about a federal office here, the United States Senate.
I understand that. I understand that. I got to tell you, between that and Spitzer and who else? We don't even know who their wiretap is.
Right. Well, probably you and me.
Right. Well, right. Okay.
That'll be pretty boring.
It looks like, in terms of that seat, a lot of people are going after Jesse Jackson for that. Progressive Democrats of America are trying to get that and get him there. So that's kind of interesting.
There's a lot of support in Chicago for Jan Schakowsky, too. On Fridays very often do a live hour on the Chicago affiliate, and we brought this subject up 2 or 3 weeks ago, and a lot. I was surprised by, I'd say, 80% of the calls.
She really is.
Yeah.
Also, it looks like the House and Senate leadership said that they are expecting Congress to approve that $15 billion auto bailout package by the end of the week, and that they are looking at that, and that they are also, Nancy Pelosi, of course, said yesterday that this was not going to be a blank check and that she expects a plan by the end of March. Let me just go back to our Illinois governor. And the one thing is that I read a lot of the complaint and the supposed things that he said, alleged things he said on that wiretap. And I got to say, if that's the case, he's got a trafficant problem in that I also think he has a grandiose kind of manic illness.
Oh, really?
That's the other thing I think is the guy.
You think the guy is internally and personally out of control?
Oh, totally. I mean, go back and read that complaint. It is, you know, Tom, with your psychological insight and knowledge, you're going to go nuts.
Yeah. Well, that's tragic, Ellen. That's
it is tragic.
Yeah.
Okay. So they are expecting that oil bailout.
Now, what about John Ensign's? John Ensign from Nevada says he's inclined to filibuster any money for the auto industry.
The only one. It looks like McConnell is going to.
And you've got Sessions and his buddy, I forget his name, down in Alabama. You know, the two Republican senators from Alabama talking about filibustering it because they want to protect the non-American auto manufacturers. I mean,
right.
You know, it's like, will the Republicans be able to mount a successful filibuster at this point?
I just don't know how the rules are going to work on this. And, again, if the White House is behind it, they may have a little trouble with that.
Is behind the filibuster?
That's right.
So then the Democrats might have some trouble.
No, not behind the filibuster. I'm sorry. It looks like the White House is aligned with the Democrats on this.
Oh, really? So the White House, because
yes.
Yesterday what I was hearing was that George Bush was, maybe, I don't know.
No. They sent, according to Dana Perino, they sent negotiators up to the Hill, the White House, at 8:30 on Saturday night, and she said the bill is beginning to look like something we could support.
Okay, interesting.
So
although he gets to appoint a czar, and then that czar gets to say, okay, the first thing you got to do is bust the union, right?
Right.
So we're back to step one. It's just more of the Republican war on working people. I mean, it's just
right. One other last piece of news. I keep going to the governor thing, but there are apparently some local news reports in Chicago that are saying that it was Rahm Emanuel who blew the whistle on the governor.
Oh, that's interesting. Was this a matter of just being tired of having a guy who was out of control being in his state?
I guess so.
Yeah.
And, you know, Rahm Emanuel's not the kind of guy that is going to say, Governor, I think it's time to go to the local mental hospital.
Right.
He'll say it's time to go to the local jail if you know Rahm Emanuel.
Right. He just blew it up, you know. Yeah.
Right.
Interesting. And Patrick Fitzgerald is just the guy to come along and do it, apparently.
Right. Well, that's exactly Fitzgerald's, you know, that's his shtick.
Yeah. Yeah, and he's built a strong case, apparently. It's at least from what's being leaked. And I think, frankly, that they're doing a lot of the leaking so that people don't get into a conspiracy theory about this was because Blagojevich was supporting the workers at Republic Windows and Doors,
right,
and going against the Bank of America. But we'll see. We'll see.
This is going to be interesting. Never a dull moment in politics.
You're right. You're absolutely right. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks for our daily news update,
Thank
Ellen.
You.
Great talking with you. 57 minutes past the hour. Alan Jablonski coming up next. The consumer rights attorney and licensed mortgage broker is the author of the book Successfully Navigating the Mortgage Maze. What can you do if the banks are coming after you? Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to the place where smart people get their news. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Last time we had Alan Jablonski on, with the lines just lit up. A lot of people had questions. What do I do in my situation with my home, with my, you know, whatever, my credit cards, my debt problems? Alan Jablonski is a consumer rights attorney and licensed mortgage broker. He's the author of a new book, Successfully Navigating the Mortgage Maze. Mortgage-maze.net is his website. And also, is that AIConsumerWatch.com, Alan, or do I have that wrong?
Actually, it's AJConsumerWatch.com. We had a little problem with always putting that hyphen in Mortgage Maze, so we decided to use the company name.
Oh, AJ as in Alan Jablonski, AJConsumerWatch.com.
Okay, that's great.
Yeah. That the typeface on my computer screen here makes an underlined J causes the anyhow. let me just shout out to our listeners here. If you have a question for Alan Jablonski, he's here. He's on the line. He's going to be with us for a little bit, and we'll take your calls. 866-303-2270. If you're wondering what to do. Alan, we're in the second quarter. Foreclosure rate in the United States was at 5.59%. The third quarter, it was 6.99%. I'm guessing this fourth quarter that we are just wrapping up, it's going to be even higher than that.
The numbers can continue to grow, and far into 2009, the numbers are just going to continue to go up.
Why?
Basically, there's a few reasons. First, the lenders and the loan servicers and their investors are not really working with people. We keep hearing about how many hundreds of thousands of people are getting help, and what's really happening is they're doing short-term fixes for a long-term problem. As I stated last time on the show, the option arm loan is one of the most devious loans that people got conned into, thought they were going to be able to get their dream home, and, you know, basically within a year or two, they were giving their home away by making that teaser payment. That loan, a lot of those are resetting this year and will continue to reset through 2011. And one of the major issues now is that people are seeing that they're paying on a $500,000 mortgage on a house that's only worth $350,000.
Right.
So they're making the financial decision to walk away.
Right. Increasingly all across the country. And destroying their credit in the process as well. And I would add to that what we have is a loss of good-paying jobs in America, so we don't have the wages that can support the kind of payments for houses. And as we continue losing jobs in the United States, both to offshoring and just as a consequence of the down spiral economy, you know, once a spiral starts, it's damn hard to stop. You have to just blow right through it. You have to kick right through it, as Roosevelt did to a large extent. I mean, the economy, actually, when you look at new investment in businesses, it reached a peak in 1929 before the crash. It was back at that point in 1937. New investment. The economy wasn't all the way back, and jobs certainly weren't all the way back, but the leading indicator was there. And at that point, Roosevelt said, well, it looks like things are going well. Let's now start working on balancing the budget, and let's scale back the WPA and some of these big programs. And boom, in 38, the bottom fell back out again. You know, it dropped back down a full 10%, which was about, you know, a third of the total climb that it had made. Because the economy, we hadn't gotten to the other side of that wall, as it were. And we've got this very, very big wall that's been erected by a combination of of losing jobs, insane trade policies, and an economy that's in a downward spiral. And it's going to take a lot to get to the other side of it. Any thoughts, additions, or arguments with that analysis?
I don't believe that we're going to see a slowdown anytime soon of people losing their jobs. It is going to take up a greater and greater portion of the default rates and the foreclosures that are happening. It makes right at the moment, it's making a very small percent of the overall picture. But you are right. It's going to continue to be a larger and larger percentage of the overall foreclosure rate.
Right. So, well, here, let's pick up some calls and get right into this. Lauren in Santa Fe, New Mexico, listening on KTRC, AM 1260. Hey, Lauren, you're on with Alan Jablonski.
Okay. I just want to ask a simple question. We know now that all this stuff was basically illegal. How do we fight back?
You're talking about
these loans were so poorly constructed and so bad. How did people that got them, isn't there a legal way to, fight back these banks and lenders that did this stuff?
There were violations of the Truth in Lending Act and RESPA, which is the Real Estate Settlement Procedures Act. There are many. Numbers have been thrown out from anywhere from 10% to 40% of loans have violations in them, because everybody in the lending industry was looking at what kind of market share can we get? How easy can we make it for people to purchase a home? Because they were going to get their money and the economy be damned, 2-3 years down the road. This leads me to an important topic, is that there are multiple, thousands of mortgage brokers that are trying to move into the loan modification business. And they have no business practicing law, and that's what they're doing.
We are being inundated by Alan Jablonski, by people who want to come on the radio and save the American homeowner. And then when you look into their websites, you dig a little bit deeper, what you discover is that they're selling loan consolidation, or they're selling advice, or they're selling, a 12-step program of some sort. I mean, it's like there's an entire industry that has developed around helping, and I put that in quotes, people who are in trouble. And it looks to me like 70, 80, 90% of that industry is actually not offering help. They're just predators feeding on the carcass of an economy in trouble.
People just like Lauren, who just called in, are desperate. They want to keep their homes.
Right.
You know, people want to stay in their homes. And the only company that that I've spoke with in the last couple of months, a company called Foreclosure Trackers. Now, what they do is they'll come in and they'll purchase a loan that is a non-performing asset. They'll go in and they'll buy a group of them from some investor, and then they'll offer 40 cents on the dollar, and then they'll try to work out something with the current holder of the mortgage.
At 50 cents on the dollar?
The numbers, it ranges. It depends on what they can negotiate.
No, but I mean, they're doing that in the expectation of making a profit on it.
Absolutely. But if they can turn around and offer a mortgage, a principal reduction, which isn't happening right now, if they can offer a principal reduction and a monthly mortgage payment that people can afford and that it's long-term, a 30-year fixed loan, I'm all for it. If people want to stay in their homes, I'll
sure.
support any
yeah,
action.
Even if they're making some money on the side. Is there a link to them over at ajconsumerwatch.com, Alan Jablonski?
There isn't currently. I just spoke with their CEO, Robert Lee, actually earlier this morning, and their link is or their website is foreclosuretrackers.com. But here's the problem is that they can't if you call them up, they can't just purchase your loan. They're looking to buy, you know, large portfolios to end up trying to help people. The people who are facing foreclosure right now or a reset need to contact a consumer rights attorney in their local area that knows real estate law.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to be your answer.
And how do you find such a person?
You can go on, if you've got the web at your fingertips, mm-hmm. go on, do a Google search for a consumer rights attorney and loan modification, and make sure it's an attorney and check what your city are.
And plug in your city and state. Okay, Alan Jablonski is with us. He's the author of The Mortgage Maze. He's a consumer rights attorney, and a licensed mortgage broker. AJConsumerWatch.com, his website. We'll be taking your calls at 866-303-2270 for Alan right after this break.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman,
Rachel Maddow,
Lionel,
and more.
Download all of your favorite shows with Air America On Demand. Sign up now at airamerica.com.
Both never to come back.
Minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Alan Jablonski on the line with us, the consumer rights attorney, licensed mortgage broker, author of the book Successfully Navigating the Mortgage Maze, and his website, ajconsumerwatch.com, as in Alan Jablonski. And, Alan, let's pick up some phone calls here for you.
Okay.
Jim, Brooklyn, New York, you're on the line with Alan Jablonski.
Hello. I was recently laid off from my job, and I'm just wondering, Are employers legally required to pay vacation time that has been accrued, or does that just depend on their generosity?
Well, actually, sir, that's not my area of law, and I don't want to be a jack of all trades. What you need to do is speak with a employment law attorney in your state, and it depends on what the state laws are and federal laws that
is there
apply.
Is there an agency in New York State that that Jim should contact, Alan, for that kind of information?
I am not aware of it. Being out here in California, there are so many entities.
Isn't there basically a Department of Labor in every state that you can contact with that kind of question?
I'm sure there is. What they call themselves, though, may vary from
right. The other thing you could do, Jim, is call your member of the House of Representatives. They're usually more responsive than senators. They get, because they're, you know, small, they serve a smaller constituency and they're more on the ground. And
okay.
And every member of the House of Representatives has people on their staff whose only job is to help out constituents, to help, you know, deal with problems or issues or whatever. So whoever your representative is, you might want to give them a shout, too. And
thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks a lot for the call, Jim. And you can find those phone numbers, by the way. You go to callcongress.org. It's a website we put together that has toll-free numbers that gets you right to the House of Representatives in the U.S. Senate. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. Your questions for Alan Jablonski, wrapping up this half hour. Bob in Los Angeles. Hey, Bob, you're on with Alan.
Hi, how are you? That guy on the employment, if it's a part of compensation, yes, they're obligated to pay it. Typically, what companies will do today is they'll tell you you have to take it within the year. If you don't, you lose it. That's part of your employment compensation package. But my question is this. A substantial number of loans were income stated or liar loans. Invariably, those people took out loans which substantially exceeded one-third of their income with respect to mortgage payments. I would imagine that number is around 33%. Under the circumstances, there really is no help for these people. There's no way that they're going to be able to afford those homes, even with restructured mortgage payments, unless, of course, there's substantial reduction in principal. Now, is any agency that you know willing to help these people. Other than HUD, not HUD, but the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mae, I understand that they're offering to restructure loans, but those loans still have to abide by certain standards. That is, whether or not you can afford it, what your income is. And as we know, income has fallen substantially, and that a lot of people who are in these binds have lost good jobs. So what do you do for them?
Well, what I can tell you is that the last time I was on the show with Tom, I invited people across the country to email at alan@ajconsumerwatch.com. I want to hear about principal reductions because both the government and the lenders are all talking about how they're helping people, and it's all smoke and mirrors as far as I can see. The people who responded to me before are getting modifications that are very short-term in nature, 2 years, 3 years. The one person I heard up to 5 years where they were giving them an interest only, but you're only delaying the inevitable. These people need principal reductions. It can be done. It's less costly than foreclosures. The lenders and the investors can save themselves a good dime if they just work with people to lower the principal amount.
But they're not. You know, Alan, they're not doing it. And, you know, during the last Republican Great Depression, Franklin Roosevelt put together an agency that bought people's mortgages and then, you know, reorganized them, restructured them, because most of the mortgages back in the 20s, frankly, were five-year balloons. And turned them into 30-year long-term mortgages. And by the 1950s and 60s, as that program completely unwound itself, the government actually showed a profit on
it. The politicians in D.C. Can thank themselves 6 months to a year from now for not acting on this right now. I don't know if a new Obama administration is going to really move to help the homeowners. Mm-hmm. But realistically speaking, do you help somebody stay in their home by lowering their principal right now, or does the FDIC come in 6 months from now and insure all of those deposits on a bank that just went under because they wouldn't work with their
which none of which addresses the third question, which was, or the third dimension of this, which is what the caller was talking about, which is all these liar loans, many of which the homeowners had no idea that their income was being overstated by the loan originator. I mean, you know,
absolutely.
And it was just a massive amount of that. Let's pick up can you stick around, Alan?
Sure can.
Because I've got a bunch of calls here at 866-303-2270 for you. We'll continue the conversation here. What do you do? What should we do as a society as well?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-303-2270.
This is Paul Schaefer, and you're listening to Air America.
This is your home for progressive talk. AirAmerica.com.
So mommy tickled Santa Claus underneath his beard so snow white. What a laugh it would have been if Daddy'd only seen mommy kissing Santa Claus last night. Oh, what a laugh it would have
been. Yes, the season is upon us. And speaking of strange things, our conservative alert for the day. Want to say something nice about George Bush? Well, if you work in his administration, you received this morning a two-page memo outlining talking points about his last 8 years in office. It's called the Speech Topper on the Bush Record. And it reminds these folks that Bush kept the American people safe. What about that 9/11 thing that he failed to stop? Ignore that. Lifted the economy after the attacks by cutting taxes. Yeah, that worked out real well. Fought AIDS in Africa. We really haven't yet fully funded that program, have we? And maintained the honor and dignity of his office. Yes, very honorable. All those Iraq amputees that Bush is inviting in for a hug and a photo op. This is an administration, frankly, that makes any of the moral failings of the Clinton administration seem noble, frankly. Anyhow, back to the topic at hand. Alan Jablonski is with us. He's a consumer rights attorney, licensed mortgage broker, author of a book the new book, Successfully Navigating the Mortgage Maze. His website, ajconsumerwatch.com. And Alan, pick up some phone calls here. Continue with us.
Tom, I'd like to mention something before we go to the next caller, if we could.
Please.
November 25th, I called Hope for Homeowners. I don't like speaking off the cuff about programs that the government is touting that are going to help people. So I called them and basically told them that I was in distress, that I was facing imminent foreclosure. They put me on hold for about an hour and a half, only to take my information, told me their counselors were busy and that they would get back to me within 24 to 48 hours. It's been 15 days, and I'm just hoping that somebody calls me back to tell me what they're doing and not doing, because they're certainly they didn't offer me any help.
This is the Help for Homeowners hotline that's operated by the Bush administration's Housing and Urban Development Program, HUD.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's
sad news.
But here's the thing, though. Everyone has to remember that the lenders in the investment community are behind these programs. Hope Now, Hope for Homeowners. There is nothing. Many people have been conned into going 90 days late on their mortgage to qualify for a modification. I strongly suggest that you don't do it and wreck your credit just to qualify for a modification, because there is no law that requires these lenders to work with you.
So, in other words, you can say, I'm not 90 days late, but I'm telling you right now, Charlie, I'm walking away from this thing. In other words, you can play hardball with them even when you're not late.
Well, you could play hardball and they'll tell you to go fly a kite. What you really need to do is find a good attorney who can assess your loan documents and find the violations
and threaten them.
Beat the lender over the head.
Right. So threaten the lender. So if you have a liar loan and you are the liar, you're probably just playing a lot of luck and rightly so, arguably. If you have a liar loan and you had no idea that mortgage broker wrote down that you were earning three times what you were in order to qualify for an initial low rate, or you have a mortgage, where you were not informed of the terms of it in a way that made sense to you, then you can fight it.
Sense? No, I don't know very many people on the day that notary plunks down a bunch of papers in front of you and says, sign here, initial here, sign here, initial here. I know many lawyers who never read their loan documents and just trusted their broker or lender that it was true and everything was right.
Yep.
I'd say 80% of the problem rests with the lending industry.
First time I bought a house, this was back in the 70s, I actually sat in the bank's office and I read the mortgage document that they gave me. And it made them crazy because it took me about 20 minutes. And the guy was so angry with me that I was sitting there wasting his time reading this document. And I did it after he said, sign here to say that you've read this. I was 25 years old. I said, I'm going to take this seriously, what he just said. And I actually had some objections to it. And they said, sorry, Charlie, so in any case.
Take it or leave it.
And the
numbers say that 80% of people who get surprised with a higher rate or higher fees sign anyways because it's such a headache to go through the process.
Yeah, or they think that if they go through the process, it's going to get even worse. John in Washington, you're on the air with Alan Jablonski. Hey, John.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for taking my call. Well, Mr. Jablonski, what I'm kind of interested in is the fact that a lot of moderate-income people that are homeowners are also charge card holders with large balances on their charge cards. And because there are no usury laws, sometimes these people, when they turn around and they may be late on a payment or something, their rates of interest are sometimes quadrupled, from maybe 7% to 28 or 30%, huh? So basically, if you're sitting in a home and you turn around and your payment, say you have a substantial amount of charges, and your payments, say, go from $200 a month to $400 or $800 a month because of the quadrupling of your interest rates, I was wondering what kind of effect that would have on homeownership for most people that are in moderate income levels that don't have substantial savings. And I don't think anybody's looked into that, and I'm wondering how many homes would actually be foreclosed on. Because it almost happened to me where I had excellent credit, but my wife, we had two charge cards with the same company, and I happened to inherit some money because my mother-in-law passed away. And my wife went to pay off one of them, and then she ended up making a duplicate payment. They're both at the same bank, and she made a duplicate payment to the same card that she just paid off, just by making a mistake when she sent the check. So the next month, my interest was up to about 28%. And I told her, I said, fortunately, honey, we're at a stage in life now where you've just inherited this money, we can pay the card down. But if I hadn't been able to pay the card down because of that inheritance that I received from my wife's mother, I would have been in foreclosure myself. And this is back about probably 4 or 5 years ago. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's like I think that somebody should really look into actually see how many people are actually being,
squeezed by their credit cards. I got it, John. And a more holistic perspective on this, Alan Jablonski.
What it does affect is the debt to income ratio. And one of your prior callers also discussed this, speaking about one third to an A paper loan needs to be under a conforming loan insured by Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, needs to be under 45% debt to income ratio. If you make 10 grand, all of your payments, credit cards, taxes, property taxes, car loans, credit cards, etc., cannot exceed 45%. Back in the heyday of the mortgage business, when everyone was playing it fast and loose, a lot of these subprime lenders were going up to 55 and 60% debt to income ratio. And that there is an effect on that. And you need to, anybody out there right now who's facing these penalty interest rates, and there's some of them go up to 32%, you're never going to pay off your cards that way. You need to contact the loss mitigation department of your credit card company, and you need to work with them and tell them, look, you're burying me, and I need a little forbearance here to try to get my principal down. Sadly, I've had to threaten bankruptcy with a lot of these cases to get anyone to listen at the credit card companies.
Interesting. Thank you. We're talking with Alan Jablonski, ajconsumerwatch.com is website. And let's see here, Mike in Detroit. Mike, you're on the air with Alan.
Hi, Alan. Hi, Tom. I was wondering, I'm a real estate appraiser in the Detroit area, and I know through the subprime loans that were given, a lot of almost all, have to have the private mortgage insurance attached with it. And I don't hear anything about any of these banks on how they're collecting their money from that mortgage insurance. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I got to say that the mortgage insurance is paid not on subprime loans. That's actually what made it so easy for the private investors to come in. Subprime loans could go up to 80, 90, 100% of the value of the home and not pay mortgage insurance, because the investors were falling over themselves trying to get a market share. It's the loans that require mortgage insurance are those backed by Fannie and Freddie that exceed 80%.
Alan, we have about a minute left. In fact, we're going to push this break back by a minute just to get the answer to this. Paul in San Francisco is on the line, and he says, Paul, your mortgage broker's in jail, and you want to know what to do to avoid eviction real quickly?
Yes. My mom and my sister decided to sell the house I was living in, the family home, while I was paying their mortgage because the house so fast. And
yeah, Paul, you're breaking up here. But anyhow, so what does somebody do if their mortgage broker is in jail to avoid eviction?
Well, it's an excellent indication that this person probably wasn't following the law in your state.
The broker.
You need to get on the phone with a consumer rights attorney. There is a National Consumer Rights Attorney Association, and you can try to find somebody through that. Do a Google search, find someone local, and I would invite any consumer rights attorneys out there listening to email me at alan@ajconsumerwatch.com because I want to get you on my website as long as you're willing to work with people without breaking the bank.
Thank you, Alan. Thanks for being with us today. I appreciate it.
Visit HartmanRadio.com for live streaming video of the Tom Hartman Program. Fresh opinions and news you can use. This is your home for progressive talk. AirAmerica.com.
Before the hour, Tom Hartman with you. Just a quick reminder, tomorrow night at 7:30 to our listeners in Portland, Oregon, I'll be at Powell's Books in the Burnside location signing the new paperback edition of Cracking the Code and hopefully a few of my other titles as well. So be there, be square. Governor Don Siegelman on the line with us. Governor Siegelman, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you, Tom. I'm glad to be back on and thank you for your interest in thank you for all you have done to help expose the injustices by the Department of Justice and this Bush administration, and thank you for shedding light on how some of Karl Rove's misbehavior.
We just lost the governor. He's on his in his car on his cell phone. Hopefully he will call back shortly. But let me just lay this thing out for you while we're waiting for him to call back, assuming that you know he can get back into us. And let me say to our call screener, you've got to drop that call off the board if it's dead. Please put the person on line one on hold and do that, Shelley. Here we have a situation where you've got a very popular Democratic governor who was, doing well down in Alabama, something that was intolerable to the Republicans. And so the former 30-year best friend of Karl Rove and former business partner of Karl Rove's wife, the wife of this man, is appointed as the federal attorney down there, Laura Canary. And she decides to prosecute the governor for appointing to the Board of Hospitals an unpaid voluntary position in the state of Alabama. The guy that the previous Republican governor had appointed. This wasn't even like an exchange for a campaign contribution. I mean, it was just, he's appointed this guy. And for that, they decided to prosecute, they prosecuted him, and it was such a, and after the prosecution, turns out that there was, jury tampering, that one of the members of the jury was flirting with one of the FBI agents, and it got so bizarre that, as I recall, 50, maybe it was 48 or 49, but nearly 50 attorneys general all across the United States wrote a letter on behalf of Governor Don Siegelman, who, by the way, the moment the decision came out, was frog marched out of court, was not allowed to appeal the way that Scooter Libby was, for example, was not allowed to appeal. Just, marched right off to jail and slammed into lockdown and solitary. And Governor, you're back with us. And so now he's appealing this. DonSiegelman.com, S-I-E-I before E, DonSiegelman.com is the website you need to get to help this help this case out, because this is the case that will put Karl Rove in jail. Don Siegelman, you were in court. Was it this morning or was it yesterday afternoon?
We were there. We just left. We're on the road back to Birmingham from Atlanta, and I appreciate so much your call. And we had three judges. They were all well informed. They had done their homework. They asked pertinent questions, and I felt like we got a fair hearing. So now hopefully we'll get a fairly quick response. But this issue is really not about me, and it's Yeah, my faith will rise and fall with these three judges we left over in Atlanta. What's more important, Tom, is that Congress keep digging for the truth, and to get there, they've got to put Karl Rove under oath, and he either has to plead the fifth, a lie, or tell the truth. I don't think he's going to tell the truth because he's never had a propensity for doing that, but it is important for them to keep digging for the truth so the American people will know exactly who all was involved in using the Department of Justice as a political weapon to gain power. We know that Karl Rove, through documentary evidence, was involved in the firing of U.S. attorneys. We know through sworn testimony that he was involved in my prosecution. And now it is up to this new Congress, under this new administration, to keep pushing for the truth and give the American people the answers to those questions. Who and who all was involved and how high up did it go? And we need to know the answer to that so that we can have once again, a sense that our Department of Justice is going to treat everybody fairly and even-handedly.
Right. So, for example, if any of our listeners in California were inclined to call Senator Boxer's office and say, hey, you did a great job on Tom Hartman's show today talking about the economy. By the way, also you need to investigate what happened with Karl Rove and Don Siegelman and hold Karl Rove in contempt of Congress, or for that matter, any other senator or member of the House of Representatives. The people need to be going to callcongress.org, getting one of the toll-free numbers, and calling their member of the House or the Senate or both. Is that, do I have that right?
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, this new administration is all fired up about the economy, and of course they're going to hopefully will end this war. But settling this issue of the abuse of power and misuse of the Department of Justice is important to the preservation of our democracy and the future of our country.
Well said. Governor Don Siegelman, good luck, sir, and keep up the good fight.
Yes, sir. Thank you. I'll be back in touch. Thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Much.
Thanks so much for being with us. DonSiegelman.com, ID4E. Check it out. Coming up tomorrow, Fred Edwards of the American Humanist Association for a debate about God, faith, Christmas, and, well, being good for goodness sake. Plus, historian and author Alex Key will tell us what makes us tick. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. We all have to participate here. Have a great day. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit HartmanRadio.com. Stay tuned for Doing Time with Ron Kuby, coming up next on AirAmerica.com.